call the meeting to order.
Globe.
Roll call, please.
Maria Deanda.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Mike Fisher.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Wes Hall.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Ron Martin.
Here.
Clarence Willman. Linda Stotts Burnett.
Here.
We got a form.
Okay, announcements.
Announcements. I have one announcement. I was handed by Wes Hall, retired representative, a letter from a retired employee of Stanislaw County. It is September 9th, 2009, and council says I can read this as an announcement into the record. So letter dated September 9th, 2009 from Rusco. Attention, Stanislaw County Employees Retirement Association. On September 9th, 2009, the Rusco Board voted and unanimously approved to support Stan Sarah's position not to release information to the MSOB under the Freedom of Information Act because the request was misdirected to Stan Sarah and should be redirected to the Stanislaw County Board of Supervisors. Rusco recognizes consideration of privacy laws such as release of individual names, the contribution of monies retirees paid into the system, and violation of certain state laws protecting law enforcement. Submitted by Michael O'Neill, Rusco Board President, and any member who wants a copy of this, you can make that available after me.
Okay. Any other announcements? Okay, we run to public comment. Any member of the public may speak on any item which is on the agenda. The board will only allow comments for members of the public on any item on the agenda during consideration of the item. When the item is called, please raise your hand and the chair will recognize you. The general public at the beginning of the regular agenda during public comment period may address items under the jurisdiction of the board not on the posted agenda. However, any person wishing to make a presentation must submit their issue in written form with copies furnished to board members. Presentation will be limited to 3 minutes. Does any member of the public wish to speak? Okay. Move on to consent.
Hold on, I have something to say. Okay. Let's see here. Mr. William Andrews, consent item number 5B1, rescinded his application for service retirement effective September 7th, 2009, so he will be removed from this list in minutes.
I'm just going to make a motion to approve the consent items as amended.
Second.
Can I ask which one went through?
The first one, number one, William Andrews.
District Attorney. We have a motion and second. Any questions, issues? If not, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? So passed. Move on to 6A. Administrator.
In presentation and discussion of the June 30th, 2009 year-end reserves and audited figures, because we've had quite a tumultuous past 12 months this fiscal year, thought I would update retirement board members on initial accounting figures that are coming out. These are, while there's been some audit work done, if we don't have final audited figures, so these are not completely audited figures yet, but there are initial figures that staff have been able to produce. And I just wanted to update the board members so you get a good idea as to where we stand accounting-wise with the reserves. As you know, we receive funds from members and employers and investments. Those are the three sources of funds. And then we pay out retirement benefits. And then the law does provide for some ad hoc benefits to be provided also. And so looking at the members' contributions, reserve, there was $20.9 million in member contributions from payrolls and redeposits. We paid out about $2.5 million to refunds of members, and these are members who terminate service, often have less than 5 years of service and are not vested or not moving to another public sector retirement system, and the law provides that if they're not vested and if they're not creating a reciprocal agreement by moving on to a reciprocal public agency, they can request a refund of their contributions plus any interest that's been posted. And this board has made a policy of only posting about a 0.25% interest crediting rate, and that's the crediting rate since about 2003 that is refunded to the members. We do post an additional amount to make up the full 8% normal. And then that's only used if a member actually receives a retirement benefit. So those monies are then transferred down to help fund their retirement benefit. There were about $13 million in transfers. When people do retire, their contributions and interest are then transferred into the annuity and the cost of living portions to help fund their retirement monthly allowances. The employer's contribution reserves, the retirement board members will note that $50 million was transferred as a directive April 28, 2009 from the revocable health benefit subsidy or other health insurance reserve into the employer's advanced reserves. And so that brought that reserve that had been about $157 million to $107.9 million. In addition to that, there were contributions made for the year of about $23.4 million from all the employers, eight different employers, the bulk of that coming from Stanislaus County. And the transfers to fund pensions and a portion of the cost of living benefits for retirees amounted to $38.3 million. So the reserves were about $310 million at the beginning of the year and ended the year at $345 million as of June 30, 2009. The retiree reserves, these reserves are kept specifically, they're augmented or increased by the members and employers' contributions that are transferred to them upon people's retirement. So when a person retires, we take that individual person's actuarial cost, their present value of their cost, and so it's their contribution balance and the employer contributions that are necessary to fund actuarially their full benefit for their lifetime. You take that money and transfer it into the retiree reserves, and then out of the retiree reserves are paid the monthly benefits to retirees and beneficiaries in accordance with state law. So there were transfers from members and employers' contributions of about $51.3 million. Benefits paid out from these reserves, the vested benefits were $64.7 million. So that was a decline of about $13.4 million. So the reserves went from about $748 million down to about $735 million as of June 30, 2009. The other reserves are prior year's excess earnings that have been set aside for things such as a contingency reserve, or the legal or litigation contingency reserve, retiree health insurance, or the revocable health benefit subsidy, the $5,000 death benefit or burial allowance reserve, special cost of living for retirees with 20% or more accumulated unpaid cost of living credits. And Stanislaus County had one Tier 3 member whom, when they started the program in 1986, although the 37 Act says there's no disability benefit payments, the county offered some form of disability, and a county committee found that one person did qualify. It's very similar to a Social Security disability, have to be permanently disabled for all of their, for any job, et cetera. And the county found that there was one person, and instead of buying an annuity through Hartford or Transamerica or something, they determined that it would be best for us just to pay them on a monthly basis since we're set up to do that anyways. It's a lifetime payment. But the county has fully funded that, and we just pay that as a special reserve. For the fiscal year ending June 30, 2009, the other health insurance reserve or local health benefits subsidy, $50 million was transferred out, and about $6.9 million was paid out in benefits during the 12-month period. So the ending balance as of June 30 was about $100.9 million. The $5,000 death benefit or burial allowance reserve, we used it for about $265,000, so about $0.3 million. This pays the beneficiaries of individuals whose last work was with Stanislaus County. They retired from us. If a member goes from us to another reciprocal system, then that reciprocal system is obligated to make any death or burial allowance payments. So the payments there brings the reserve down to about $5.3 million. Special coal reserve did not have any changes because there were no payments made. And normally they would have been made in January 2009, and the board voted not to pay any special COLA payments for calendar year 2009. The legal contingency reserve dropped slightly for the payment of temporary fiduciary counsel service, the $34,810.50. And the Tier 3 disability payments left a balance of $13,425.92 for that one. I apologize, the exhibits, I apparently did get a little misconstrued or whatever with another item, but that Exhibit A basically outlines all of those reserves, the beginning balances, what happened to those balances, and then the ending balances as of June 30th. To give you the detail that we're seeing. So the fund went from about $1.3 billion in reserves down to about $1.058 billion end of June 30th, 2009. The next exhibit, Exhibit B, does show the investment activity. And this year, of course, there were tremendous losses in investment activity that normally does not occur, but it has for the last 2 years. I wanted to break out and show the board what happened, and specifically the first 6 months versus the last 6 months, so you can see the dramatic difference, and particularly the change in the market value of securities. Now, with bond interest income and stock dividend income, those are obviously cash payments. Those are positive income coming in. So there's about almost $39 million in cash coming in from bond interest and stock dividends. There was a net loss on sale of bonds of about $2.7 million during the year. There was a net loss of about almost $160 million on the sale of stocks, with the largest portion of that being in the first 6 months. And then the securities change in market value, the first 6 months, the securities value went down about $228 million, and then they came back $133 million the last 6 months. So there was a net change of about $95 million of loss in market value on securities. The other items there, the securities lending, cash income, commission recapture, and interest on cash are noted there. And then the fees that are paid to investment managers, custodial services, investment consultant, and actuarial services, and then our administrative costs are all noted on there. So the total net investment income loss activity for the year was a loss of $222.9 million as of the end of June 30th, 2009. And this is the accounting. This is how we account for it. So this is the accounting for that loss, which is at market value. The actuary will come up with a different figure, and they come up with what is the value of our assets. They will come up with an actuarial value of assets that will be different than this, but they will use this information to derive that, because they'll use a five-year smoothing and they'll have a quarter, 80%, 120% of market, quarter, and so on. So they'll use this information, but they will come up with a different value of assets for the actuarial study. Then the third item I wanted to kind of look at, covers the reserves and investments and so on, is looking forward, some thoughts and looking forward. Again, it's just a presentation, we can have some discussion, but no action today. Is that there is this balance of about $100.9 million in the other health insurance reserve, or the local health benefits subsidy reserve, as of June 30th, 2009. And Exhibit C shows the projected need of that reserve specifically for the revocable health benefits subsidy for retirees of about $2.8 million for the 5 months in this fiscal year that those payments will be made up through December 1st, 2009. And a cost of EMTI a little under $71,000 for a total of about $2.9 million that is projected to be encumbered that will be paid out of this reserve. That has $100.9 million. If you take that amount out and the $10 million that the board has already set aside for this fiscal year for employer contributions and look at setting aside money to pay for the losses, the $30.8 million in losses that are associated with the non-valuation assets, that would leave about $57 million for potentially future offsets of employer contributions to be set aside, and that would probably be over like a four-year period to kind of bridge the gap between now and when the county pays off its pension obligation bond in August of 2013. Let's see, the other bail allowance reserve, $5,000 death benefit, is a balance of about $5.3 million. We're having the actuary study to see if that $5.3 million is sufficient at this time to pay that or not. And we could be looking at moving that into the valuation reserves acknowledging that the county board of supervisors did approve this benefit and the attorney board funded it with excess earnings. And so it is basically a board of supervisors approved benefit. So we can look at that into the future. A special coal reserve may be used to help augment that if the balance for the $5,000 death benefit reserve comes in at $6 or $7 million. We could potentially use some of the special coal reserve money to make sure that that is fully funded. The litigation or legal contingency reserve stands at about $3.3 million, and my thoughts at this point are to just kind of leave that in there given the state of affairs that we have currently and the potential for actions to be taken in the future. So this report just kind of gives you a preliminary update on the figures of the CMA of June 30th, 2009. There's no action on anything today, but the board can certainly discuss the figures. Any questions?
Any questions on this item? Okay, you know the next item?
Okay, the next item is the summary of our meeting with the County Board of Supervisors Chair, Brenda Martini, the CEO, Rick Robinson, Board Chair Gordon Ford, and myself. We met for lunch with Mercedes. And these were some issues that were talked about, pension spiking, prospective retirement benefits, employer contributions over the next few years. And again, here's kind of the bridge between now and the POV payments. Actuarial work, county's looking at doing some actuarial work related to the prospective retirement benefits and may want to have a committee of the board formed to kind of bounce ideas, some ideas back and forth from that work. Let's see, to discuss release of retirees' names and dollars to the public. The burial allowance reserve, $5,000 death benefit was discussed, and the current quarterly of the actual value of assets, which is 80 to 120% of market, and we acknowledge that some systems are going to different quarters, 60, 140, 150, 50. Any questions or any questions?
Tom, I'm glad to. Jim, you want to go first?
Sure.
Because you were at
the I think he did a pretty good job summarizing what went on. So I don't really have much to add to that.
I think it's great that you had the meeting. On the issue of spiking, what authority does this board have? I mean, I thought we were confined to saying to the employer and the employee associations, you can do what you want, but you're obliged to pay X dollars because we figure that's what it costs, and that we were confined to giving them that figure, but they can do whatever they want to each other. I mean, it's whatever they agree upon. Or do we actually, can we say, you know, you can't spike above a certain percent, or we get to review your last year's compensation if you double my salary, or I mean,
we have no legal authority. That Stansera has no legal authority to question. What we do is we pay out the benefits based on the compensation that is received, based on the contributions that are received for that compensation from each of the employers. We don't set the compensation. We do say that you need to pay on all anything that is considered retirement compensable. And the law is relatively vague on it. But the courts have come down with the Ventura case and been much more specific as to what is includable and what is not includable.
The reason I ask is I read an article where the CalPERS was suing the city of Beverly Hills because Beverly Hills had taken some guy's salary and, like, given him a two-thirds increase in his last year and said, and CalPERS said, no, that's against our spiking guidelines. You can't do that. And Beverly Hills was, I guess, suing CalPERS to make them do it. I don't know how it ended, but
right.
But the issue was, you know, no one's paid for that benefit at that level for
forever.
The benefit.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
But we so do not, we don't have that authority.
To my knowledge, we do not have any authority to
authority.
Because when the county goes ahead and approves for things that they can't afford to pay for, like enhanced benefits, and of course there's the spiking, that's an issue too. Can the retirement board say, you know, okay, you're approving this, you need to put more money in the pot to cover it?
Well, and that comes out with the actuarial study each year. That's why why the actuarial study, we try to do it on an annual basis to keep track of what's happening year by year by year. Because obviously the actuary makes assumptions, as we know, that go out 20, 30 years. And they may prove to be true or may prove not to be true. People will die at various ages and they have an average that will occur at. And they check those. A lot of those assumptions are checked every 3 years with the actual experience. But every year we're looking at this is what the contributions are necessary. And they see who retires every year, what they're getting on retirement, and projecting out what is that liability based on the average age of that person may live to. And so they're seeing the final results. We're just passing on information saying this person makes $1,000 a month or $3,000 a month, whatever, and here's the list of 2,700 retirees, and this is what they're making per month. And they project out what the cost of living and how long you're going to live and so on, and come up with this is what you need to contribute to make those payments.
All right, Tom, are we ever involved in the process itself where the county says to the association, you know, we want to give you 3%, the association says, no, we want 10, you can afford it. And at some point, are we the mediator that says the 10% costs X dollars and the 3% will cost Y dollars over time? I mean, is that information factored into the employee associations and the county as they negotiate?
We normally don't enter into negotiations.
So we don't, as a resource, we don't supply information?
We don't normally do that. We are used as a resource if both the county and the unions are looking at perhaps some specific benefit, like with the enhanced benefits, where there's a drive for both the unions and the management of the county or employers to look at a certain benefit structure and what is the cost of that structure, what is the cost of those benefits, and then we will produce an actuarial study that will say this is the cost of that particular benefit. That is normally where Stansera has added information into the process, but we don't get involved with year-to-year negotiations on salaries or benefits and so on. If we are specifically requested into the meeting, if there's like a retirement issue or something that maybe the parties don't quite understand and we can add something to that, we will do that. But that is very rare. That doesn't occur very often.
I just want to say something about spiking. I know that the focus right now is on those people that are making above what their final salary was and the impacts that has on the retirement system. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, because if I'm making, you know, $10,000 a year working right now, and then when I retire I'm making $12,000, then that's wrong. And we know where that happens, and there, to a certain degree, there are some tools to control that. The downside of it is the ones that are the least costly, your clerks that make the minimum amount of money, that can cash out 120 hours in a calendar year. In a fiscal year, 160 actually, that counts towards their retirement, their final compensation. It helps them, because remember, most of those people are going to get a pension below that, but still keeps them below the poverty level. So again, we're focusing on approximately 5%, and that's always what happens, is we focus on the cause of the problem, which is 5%, that's going to negatively affect those people who have not caused the problem, which are the 95%. I love that particular article that you said that you sent, which capped the amount of pension you can get to a percentage of your final salary, whether it be 80%, 75%, whatever. But to totally eliminate the ability to cash out and per the Ventura decision to contribute to your final compensation, that I think overall is wrong.
Well, I don't even disagree necessarily with spiking. I mean, I think if the jurisdiction and the employee groups want
to
do it, if somebody warrants it, I don't mind that as long as it's paid for. I think our business is making sure that it's the money's in the system.
I agree, but we're not normal. If I remember correctly, when the negotiations were being done, I mean, I can't remember if we had a special actuarial review of what the cost would mean to the retirement system at the time. hasn't been that long ago. But what you end up, what ends up happening is in the county, something more bad happens, and it was a series of bad events, you know, the economy, et cetera, and here we are. And had we not had these ad hoc benefits, you know, then the county would have actually had no one or nothing to go to get some money, like $60 million. So, you know, there's some good things and bad things that have come about this, and we need to look at, again, the big picture, the long-term picture, the immediate picture, and again, not make these reactionary, take these reactionary actions.
Well, I was talking to a retired highway patrolman, and what they do, you can cash out your vacation, whatever you expect, not to exceed 90% of your final salary. So yeah, if you cash out and you can bring it up to that point, but you would not get, not to exceed 90% of your final salary. So, you know, yes, you're leaving that in there where a person has the ability to cash out some of their vacation. However, they're not going to be spiking way up and getting considerably more in retirement than what they got while they were working. So I think that's kind of a fair thing, too. You can do it, but not to exceed 90%.
I think I brought to the table the example of an individual, the only individual that I can think of, but I'm sure there may be more, that was had said that he was going to retire within a certain period of time. The county moved that individual to a higher paying position the year he was going to retire. We actually ended up having to take special action so that the Board of Supervisors could, in a backdoor sort of way, pay this individual the amount that he was technically promised in a pension when he was hired. And he ended up getting, I believe, more than what his final salary was in total compensation.
To keep us back on track, remember we were discussing a meeting that occurred
This is a good meeting, Tom.
This is part of this general conversation as examples.
Yeah, good. Very good summation, Tom. From an historical standpoint, comment you made. At the time when the county was looking at enhanced benefits, an actuary was done. That's why the cost was determined.
So
the present value
knew
cost
at
that time what the enhanced benefits were. And as I stated before, Stan Sarah used its contingency reserves to pay for that cost. I guess I'm kind of surprised that item number one is there at all, because Tom wrote a very detailed memo to this board directed to the county on the issue of pension spiking, and Tom and this board were told to butt out and mind their own business.
That's right.
It was a fairly heated exchange at that moment, so I'm questioning why it's on there at all, why it even came up. It's a benefit issue that the county has control over to some degree. The Ventura decision has been made very clear from a legal case standpoint, and counties and municipalities are bound by that case decision. I'm sure if it wasn't there, this issue wouldn't be relevant at all. But it's there nonetheless, and until a higher court decides to change it, we're bound by it to a certain degree. So, again, very well done, Tom, and certainly we're trying to be a partner in the process.
I think what the county is looking at on that, one solution is to base an average of your last 3 years, what the final number is for new employees.
Right.
That we see as a fix, and that's probably something we'll most likely do next year.
And that was also a negotiated item.
Right.
And you know, on number five, Darren, you probably, to release the retirees' names and dollar amounts, aren't public safety people protected by a law to not release their names?
No. 832.7 of the Penal Code only pertains to personnel records, and the courts have already determined that salary information for active law enforcement is not considered part of your personnel record as outlined in the
We're not talking salary, we're talking about their retirement benefits. Because say
well,
they
that's,
put...
But that's cost
it
information.
Fall under a different...
No.
Because,
the courts
I mean,
have already... I mean, that... we're you know, we're still talking about an item within this memorandum, but from the case law decisions that I've read and not to speak out of turn from counsel here, but the 2007 Cal Supreme Court case, it's made pretty clear by the Supreme Court that and other appellate decisions prior to that personnel records determined by the court under 832.7 of the Penal Code is not salary information. They're talking about home addresses, disciplinary items within there, medical information that's in there, those types of things, not salary information.
Names and salary, though, for public safety, if you've got a disgruntled person out there and they see your name and...
Yeah, but that could fall. That could be with anybody, yeah. not just peace officers. So, and again, 832.7 specifically is talking about active law enforcement. It has some bearing on sealed records after retirement, but it pretty much pertains to active law enforcement. Okay.
Any other comments on Tom's report?
What a memory, Darren.
Okay, we move on to the next one, correspondence.
We received a letter from Bob Palmer and from Executive Director for SACR, State Association of County Retirement Systems, related to the official duties of elected board members and how that is part of their duties. Retirement board issues are part of their duties, take precedence over other duties, and that some comments about fiduciary responsibility, that we discharge our duties for exclusive purposes, providing benefits, minimizing employer contributions, and defraying reasonable expenses of administering the system. Of course, duty to participants and beneficiaries, participants, and the other group.
Any comments?
Long overdue. So there's been a few people that have actually been denied attendance from their department head. You cannot participate outside of the regular retirement board meeting. So no. No educational conferences, nothing. So I think this is kind of where this came from. So it's long overdue.
I actually have that law posted to my desk. The issue almost came up not too long ago. So I made sure I cite it. My number's not as good as Darren's. But it's something I think periodically, not just us, but some of our bosses need to be reminded of.
So they wouldn't let you go to a conference?
It wasn't me. I've never been denied, but my time in
I can see that. I can see people.
My time of involvement is in question.
I think Darren was referring more globally than just art.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to committee reports and recommendation for actions. Standing Committee, Internal Governance, Ron Martin.
Yes, the Internal Governance Committee met on Wednesday, July 8th, with our new audit firm, Macias, Jeannie, and O'Connor. We met with Richard Green as the partner and Debbie Chan, the manager. They were in the process of doing field work and completed the work during that week. They were back to complete the audit August 21st through the 25th. And should have a CAFR for our review, or our CAFR that has been reviewed by them to present to the board and present to the audit committee on October 27th, and then we'll present it to the board. We met today. A while back we talked about doing a operational or a risk review of the operations, and we met today. We had sent out proposals probably 4 months ago, and didn't get very good response. We sent them out again probably 2 months ago and received back two this time. And the committee reviewed those and went with the firm of Varvernick, Tyne, and Day, or as we like to call them, VTD, since their pronunciation is very difficult. We selected them as the audit firm to do the operational audit and risk assessment. What they do is come in and look at all of our operational procedures, do a risk analysis on that, and determine those areas that were not at risk, and come back to us with any areas that might have risk associated, and some options as to what we can do to solidify that. Our belief is we're in pretty good shape, but I think that gives us a comfort feeling to know that not only do we have the financial review with the outside audit firm, but now we have an operational review to make sure things are being done.
Where are they from?
They're out of Pleasanton. They're a smaller firm, but they do, I personally know they do a lot of banks, although I've never dealt with them, and they also do a lot of governmental work. So the other firm that bid on the job was KPMG, which is one of the big three, a very large firm. BTD came in at about $16,000, and although KPMG indicated the scope to be more hours, they came in at about a little over three times that amount. So.
Wow.
So needless to say, we went with the lesser amount.
Any indication how long it would take?
They're showing 70 hours, so they'll probably have two people here for a week.
Any additional comments or questions? We'll move on to the next item. Yep. Haddock General Legal Counsel Committee meet. Our committee met yesterday to discuss the responses to the RFP that was sent out. One attorney and seven law firms responded to the RFP position and announcement. The one attorney who responded did not appear to have any public employment experience or even experience with public agencies at all. The committee tried to take a look at the whole issue and context of what we have. And I think if we get into an extensive discussion, we probably need to agendize discussion for the next meeting on the grounds that really on the agenda it's a verbal report rather than a full-fledged discussion. But we got into some interesting questions, I think. Starting with the premise that we really at this time have no major legal problems, and we have a few minor things with lawsuits, but we don't have any major legal promise. When we look at the proposals and the fees that are charged, and we're talking in the neighborhood of $500 an hour, if a person were to work full-time, which they wouldn't, we would never hire them full-time, but if they were to work full-time, it'd be $1 million a year. It's pretty expensive stuff, this legal stuff. And so the committee was concerned about that. In the proposal process itself, I wonder if we misled anybody or not. I was noticing in one of the proposals, it said that, quote, "We also note that Stan Sarah Board is considering staffing the position with an in-house attorney and a salary, fringe benefits, aggregate dollar amount approaching $150,000 a year. These two indications indicate expectations of significant workload for the board of general counsel." So it also appeared from some of the responses that for whatever reason, there was kind of a feeling that it was going to be a lot of work and a lot of extensive work for us, which then the committee started looking at the whole thing saying, gee, cost is an important issue. The committee kind of felt, and I don't know if the whole board would agree with it or not, that if we were spending over $150,000 a year on legal expenses, we're doing something wrong. Just plain paying a lot of money for legal expenses, unless we get some value for it, really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So we started exploring concepts and ideas, which we'll need to bring back to the full board, as I say, of how to proceed, which is really probably more the question than anything else. We need to find a way to control costs. We found with our previous legal experience that, you know, attorneys sometimes accumulate bills for a month or two and then bill you later, and controlling costs is hard, but there are ways to do it. Kicked around some ideas of possible methods of doing that, one of which is, do we need an attorney to be at every meeting? Maybe perhaps some, or meetings in general, it's not necessary. Can we do it by conference? Can we put an attorney on a speakerphone? Part of what we're looking at is the fact that at least, well, many of the law firms are located like in San Francisco. We're talking about driving time, and it's kind of awkward to say, but maybe it's not really worth spending $500 an hour for people to drive to our meetings. So the question of what to do on that basis, maybe we could talk to the law firm and say we need a junior representative rather than somebody they're recommending to be here or to meetings. All sorts of ways in which to control costs, which then got back to the question of, is this something that the committee should be discussing with the attorneys that are submitting proposals and say, you know, we're interested in doing this at a reasonable cost, or is it something the whole board should be doing, and is it something the board should give direction to the committee? For that matter, the question of bringing firms in to discuss, is that something that the entire board wants to do? Is that something that the committee should be doing? So again, the question is, what is the appropriate action given our circumstances? Our committee did not feel any real pressure, and that's kind of odd when you think about it, in the sense that we don't have any immediate legal requirements that are not being fulfilled that we feel are significant. And so one of the questions is, do we want to simply go with a lower-priced attorney firm who's physically here to give us a certain amount of comfort, Brown Act type questions, or do we want to go with a higher-priced firm that is not physically here so much? Does the board feel that some sort of control mechanism should be in place? And if so, should that control mechanism be through some party? For example, the chair. I say that with a certain amount of comfort, knowing it's not going to be me. But assuming that the chair could control it, is there some way that the chair would be responsible to keep track with the attorneys? Or is it possible to tell the attorneys themselves that you'll have a not-to-exceed fee monthly, annually, or whatever that could be on the table? But we say, you need to control your own costs in the sense of knowing how much time you're putting into it. And does that make sense, given the fact that they have to know what's going on? Does the board want to interview people? And if so, is that going to be closed session, open session, those kind of questions? So I would say that we came away with as many questions as we felt we had answers and need to figure out how to proceed. But if we start with the premise that the three of us agreed to, that we don't have an immediate problem, don't have an immediate major concern, and that cost has to be a concern for us, it seems like it'd be logical to come back to the full board for some sort of a discussion of the process, procedures, and what is wanted from the legal aspect, and whether or not the controlling cost is a logical way to go. I'd like to open it first to any of the other two members of the committee if I have failed to mention something or said something wrong. Not?
Who's on the committee besides yourself?
Ron, Maria, and myself.
The people, may I ask Ron a question? Or Tom, I mean.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
The people that we had discussed, Tom, that had experience in this type of position, had prior experience with that, they're still talking about this $500 an hour and stuff?
We had firms.
Right, legal firms.
We had only one person.
Okay, but
as
the ones that, the three specific ones that you and I talked about.
Well, the three from San Francisco that have 37 Act experience are Hanson Bridget, which we involved one for tax counsel, Reed Smith, Harvey Lederman, and Jeff Reed, we used them for temporary fiduciary counsel, and Manet, I guess, and that's Ashley Dunning.
In the firms he's talking about, Lederman was at 560, Ashley from Manet was at 515, and Blum was at 463 per hour. To give you an idea of the sort of ballpark we're talking about.
I'm sorry.
Are those just three specific ones that you and I talked about?
I can't recall our specific conversation, but those are the ones that deal mostly with 37X systems.
To give you the other prices, to let you know, they're $300 and $285 roughly in the other.
Okay, but the three people that we talked about, that Tom and I and Hank and I talked about, were people who had been in this job before with counties around this area. They know, I know that they wouldn't have been recommended if they were requesting $500 an hour, because the person that was...
I'm dealing with who we got.
Okay, I'm just...
I don't know if they didn't apply.
I'm just wondering what happened. There must have been a breakdown in communication someplace. Because this...
Just in response.
The person that recommended these people was well aware of what happens on a daily basis in this position, and he would never do that type of thing, I don't think.
Well, as I say, I'm dealing with what we got, and I think partly the committee was dealing with the fact that we're talking quite expense. I think there's negotiations that could be done, and I think that's going to need to be done, whether it be done in a committee or board level or however you want to do it. But it's what do you want for your money? In other words, what expectations?
Yeah, a lot of the little cities and special districts around here will take a local firm,
sure,
and they're on retainer for $1,500, $2,000 a month.
This is what I was going to ask.
And they cover
like
the meeting.
Like the MID. In other words, I would think they have an attorney, a local attorney, I would think.
But they have their own house counsel.
But if you have, do they?
Yeah, but some of these little districts, they hire some guy to come in at $2,000 a month. He does the meeting, he does the Brown Act. It's almost processed at the meeting itself. And then they contract out for anything significant.
Sure, exactly.
Which we do here anyway, like with Lederman.
Well,
so
like our disability?
Yeah, it's the more routine stuff, they just cover it.
One of the possibilities is a recognition that for whatever reason we didn't get what we expected, because we have, as I say, reading one of them misled them to think it's a much bigger issue than we think. I don't know.
So did we give them a job description of what they're doing?
Did we give the RFP?
What we're talking about?
The RFP included the duties very similar to what the board saw for the staff person.
Job description.
The job description for a general counsel staff person, because these would be the general duties of a counsel individual. So the RFP included that. And we did get local law firms responding that are obviously much, it's 200, 285, something
285,
like that.
285,
300. $300. Local law firms did. Some Sacramento, one from Adesso, I think Stockton. So there are seven total proposals.
So, I mean, one possibility would be to get a person in here that, I hate to say it, we train only.
Well, and that's part of the question that we as a board need to decide. Do you train someone? Because we turn around, we ask questions we expect an answer to. Be it basic sort of 37 Act questions, Brown Act questions, et cetera. They're here, but then they have to go back to their office to research it, which is billable hours. So you run into that kind of a problem. And I agree, we did talk about hiring out for a very specific item, should anything get to that point. The other is, do we want to cap how much we're willing to pay and negotiate backwards that way?
Did they have a resume with him?
One of them did.
No, I said it.
Yeah. Oh, I asked him if he wanted to come work for us. He kicked me under the table.
No,
$1 million
a year. Okay, is that what you make in? I'll get the B after you if you don't answer.
We'll have to wait until we get to the closed session.
Okay.
But again, is this something we want to bring back next session for a little bit more discussion on how to proceed?
Well,
to let people think about it.
I think that what Wes has said and what Mike has said, I think is reasonable given the circumstances. I think we should focus on a local firm. I think what this board is asking is someone that you know, you want a law firm, so you don't want to pigeonhole yourself with one individual because if that individual needs time off or is sick, you've got an immediate backup. And you want staff support, you want the paralegal, you want the clerical, so you're not having to incur that obligation yourself within your own operation. And I think a local firm could provide a legal service, just like, you know, in my background, City of Waterford has a firm out of Merced that they use. City Riverbank has a local attorney that they use. A lot of the small jurisdictions, municipalities, have those services. I think Gordon's point of controlling costs, I think one person should be in charge, and that should be the administrator, in my opinion. So, because your costs will go up if board members are calling and start asking questions, that individual is going to feel compelled to get an answer back. Pretty soon you come to the next meeting and you've got a problem with an inordinate amount of billable hours and no one knows what the heck's going on. So my preference would be, I think, that a local firm can handle it. I think we could get a negotiated reasonable rate and continue to hire out for expertise with disabilities and whatnot with additional counsel under contract.
My concern was, I guess, twofold. One is, do we want or need an attorney at all of our meetings?
My preference would be yes, you do. That would be my preference. I think you can do that. That's, in other words, that's your fixed cost that you know that you're going to have every year, your meetings, and an approximate hourly rate because of their time duration. And then your other cost beyond that is going to be, you know, cost control and allocation control through your administrator.
Yeah, but how do you control costs if, say, everybody on the board is able to contact the attorney?
No.
And that's what I'm saying. We have to. You
that's
have to.
Right.
How do you restrict it, though? Because otherwise your costs then become after the control. It becomes after the fact.
You put the guy on a retainer. He gets X dollars a month. And if it gets to become unwieldy for him, he's got to come back and tell us we need more money.
But you got to have a control person, because you can't have everybody calling in saying, "Oh, I've got a question I need an answer on." And if somebody else calls, I got a question. We don't do that now. At least we shouldn't be. I don't do it. We shouldn't be doing that. And so it should be fairly easy to continue doing that as we go forward.
That's me
being
there.
Huh? Yeah.
I said I've done it.
I would agree with Darren that there should be somebody here, because you don't know, you never know who's going to show up and say something and do something that we instinctively might react to when we should.
And it's helpful to have an established firm locally that has relationships with other entities, the Bar Association, you know, the judicial system.
Those
relationships are important.
It's always a trade-off in dollars between the highly skilled professional who knows the field versus the local available who can learn or ask questions.
I think we've got some top-notch attorneys here locally that could easily step into what we're asking to do.
Other feedback from other people?
And I think this is the way to start, too. And
what?
I think we have a timeline. I think we have a date that we're not going to have county council. So I think we need to get working on this.
And again, you're saying local, not?
I say that we should try to get somebody local, start out that way.
Well, we're looking at a firm, preferably.
Yeah. Well, if we're dealing with what we got, we have to deal with what we've got.
Well, that's what we have now, in a sense we have a firm. That's what we have now. You know, when Deirdre is not here, which is the case today, we have a highly competent backup sitting in the seat.
But you see, Newman does this.
Expensive.
Riverbank does this.
Trying to butter you up.
You know, they have contracts. The lawyer, if the lawyer can't make it, the lawyer gets a backup.
Where's that resume?
And if there's any big deal, they contract out anyway.
Sure.
But we're only talking about just the stuff that goes on that Deirdre or Ed does. And we're not talking about going to these conferences and stuff like that. We're talking about strictly in-house stuff. And the times that I've seen the necessity of having an attorney in the room in a meeting, I count on one hand in the years that I've been on this committee. We get a lot of stuff from that little brown book over there, but I don't necessarily think that's, I don't think that's really necessary in many of the cases.
So back to Ron's question of, does it have to be somebody here? You're saying...
Ron says yes.
No, I say no.
Oh, you say no. I say no also.
Mike, the only thing I have a concern about is having an attorney that's representing us that's not staying current, and I don't know who's responsible for the cost. But I believe that our attorneys should be attending some of these conferences where the current information.
Oh, I do too, Maria. I'm not. I'm just.
Again, I'm not saying who pays the cost. Maybe that's something that's.
The only thing I was concentrating on was that when we have an attorney such as Deidre, she does a certain amount of things. They all need education, and they need to go to these meetings and stuff. But I'm saying make the job description such that when is their job description is to take care of what happens in the meetings, and then make that other section a different part of that. You are required to go to Washington, D.C. once a year. You're required to do blah, blah. But, you know, that's not $1 million worth of work.
The bottom line, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to interview and hire an attorney before the end of September.
I agree.
I don't know if that was something that was still negotiable with the county council to extend their time until such a point that we do hire an attorney.
Yes, the county council and I discussed it last week. And as long as the board is making a diligent effort to move forward toward obtaining counsel, then county council will continue to represent you as you
That's good to know.
Okay. So.
So we have time if we want to bring it back to the board next week, I mean next 2 weeks, for a more extensive direction, or if the group feels that we should move forward. I don't know if the group feels the committee should be interviewing people and try and weed it out with the feedback we've gotten. How do people feel in general about physically here versus on the phone?
Well, the other thing I wanted to discuss was why don't we, you know, Deidre is certainly not with us 24/7 or even 8/7 or 5/8/5. And so, you know, there are attorneys right now in Merced, there's attorneys in Stockton, there's attorneys in Sacramento or something like that. So if we, yeah, they don't work full time for the boards, I've been told.
So you're saying local would be better than...
Well, what I'm saying is that we could hire somebody who is now working for Stockton, for example. They could also be our attorney.
Well, we need to either use what we've done on RFP, or Tom, we could, do something different?
Reissue an RFP?
Be reissued or throw them all out and do something different?
Or you can negotiate with the ones you have.
And that would need to be a direction by the board, because at this stage, I think our committee is looking at the proposal we got.
Just to back up a little bit, one of the things we talked about is, number one, is does the full board want to be part of the interview once we select? Do you want the committee to make the recommendation to the full board? Okay.
I think committee.
Sure. Yeah, and does Tom, will Tom sit in on that too?
We hadn't talked about that, but...
I think he should, because he'll be working directly with...
Well, actually, no, I take that back. We did talk about it a little bit. Uh-huh. And, yeah, I agree. I need to work with the person.
But he'll be working with him, I think.
Just to give Gordon some...
Whatever people want as far as direction, it's just hard to get 9 people to agree on anything.
Just to give the chairman some guidance, I would move that we want this person or firm to be at our meetings.
At our meetings.
In person. So I would make that just because I know some of you don't think that's necessary. So why don't we clarify that for
I think course. It is because
I don't think we can take any action.
No, we can't take any action. We get a sense.
From 10 years older.
And that's okay.
Oh, I didn't say I didn't want to meet him. I just said
no,
that
to be at the meetings.
I don't want to be part of this original selection committee.
Don't you want another
right.
meeting?
No, I agree. No, I'm talking about having him
meet. Don't you want to go to another meeting?
Have to be at our meeting.
The general sense I'm getting is that most of the group is saying, rather than having a really good high-priced attorney who's far away, we're looking for a local attorney who can physically be here. Is that
that's
a
cheap.
Fair?
Yeah. Reasonable.
Expensive.
And knowledgeable.
Okay.
Sharp.
I just need... Does that... Okay, and so the committee would go back and do its work, as they say, go through the RFP responses, try and filter through that, and I get the feeling that you're saying we should talk to the attorneys as a committee, come back and
I think some contacts to some of the local firms might.
Again, we'd have to, we'd really have to back away from the process that we're doing now. We'd have to do another RFP.
We sent it out to all the local firms.
We did.
But I don't think they understood it, you know, maybe. I think it's like getting somebody to run for office. You know, you can put a notice in and say, we need to have a vice president for this board. No one's going to volunteer. You're going to have to go out and twist an arm or talk to somebody.
For this board, yes.
That's by duress.
Any board. Any board.
Isn't that right?
That's right. Have you given up trying to fight it now?
Generally, in a sense?
So we're going to have a meet. We need to meet prior to the...
The committee has to get together again and
22nd.
Sorry
about
that. Sorry,
Ron. You can take next time off.
No, we don't get out of work, Ron. I keep trying.
Okay, maybe we can piggyback okay. on our meeting 22nd?
Yes.
More meetings.
Well, due diligence.
Yeah,
that's
it's
a big day.
We'll start at 7 in the morning.
Mr. Chairman, I make a motion
here.
We move into closed session.
Do you need something before closed session?
I can read the statement. I'm more ready to go.
Well, you can make a motion.
Wait. So the minute you've already got the committee, so continue working to bring back recommendations or next steps.
Bring back something.
Okay. I don't think we're going to be ready for recommendations in 2 weeks.
Committee will continue to work. I think that's what it's going to say.
I second Darren's
okay, motion. We have a motion second. Before we go into the session, County Council has something.
Okay. Closed session is authorized under Government Code Section 54956.9, Subdivision B1B. The board will be considering two Public Record Act requests. There's a Public Record Act request from the California Newspaper Publishers Association, dated August 31st, 2009, and from the California First Amendment Coalition's Taxpayer Association, Public Records Act request, dated September 1st, 2009. Each request requests the disclosure of the names of all retirees and beneficiaries who received monthly pensions in 2009, and the monthly amount.
Okay, so I have a motion and a second for closed session. Can I have a vote? Everybody in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We're going to closed session. Thank you.
Alcoholics.
Okay. Okay. Drunk driving.
Recording is back in session.
We're recording.
We're back in session.
I will read the findings of the closed session. Motion was made by Maria DeAnda and seconded by Mike Fisher to deny the CPNA, California Publishers Newspapers Association's request of a list of each retiree/beneficiary receiving pension benefits from Stansera in 2009 and the monthly amount of their pension, including the name and monthly pension for each retiree or beneficiary. Roll call for yes to deny the request, Maria DeAnda. Mike Fisher, Darren Garrett, Wes Hall, and Ron Martin. Roll call no. Jim DeMartini, Gordon Ford, and Mike Lynch. Secondly, a motion was made by Mike Fisher and seconded by Maria DeAnda to deny the First Amendment Coalition's request of a list of each retiree/beneficiary receiving pension benefits from Stansera in 2009 and the monthly amount of their pension, including the name and monthly pension for each retiree or beneficiary. Roll call yes. Maria DeAnda, Mike Fisher, Darren Garrett, Wes Hall, Ron Martin, roll call no, Jim DeMartini, Gordon Ford, and Mike Lynch.
You've got a job. You did much better than I did.
I have a question. What if we vote 4-4 on that?
we call Clarence.
No, a tie is a defeat.
He's not here.
Yeah, the motion fails.
Motion fails on a tie.
Yeah.
How can we have a tie with 9 people?
Clarence is on
the
table.
We don't have 9 people.
He just delayed it until next month.
Somebody refused to vote.
Right.
Yeah, just delayed it next month.
That's a little quick.
Yep.
Okay, we're moving on to members' forum, and I think what I'm saying is for the next agenda, we need an item on there for a verbal report for me on this legal thing with discussion and action. Maybe we won't have to do much, but we ought to have it just in case.
the court.
Legal counsel?
It's one of these committees, ad hoc general legal counsel committee. This thing I have to report, we need to discuss it, we need to make a decision on whether we're making a decision.
I don't know what we're doing.
But that's about all I can think of, even though it's a long agenda, we probably have to throw it out. Yeah, committee on committees.
Oh, I should have brought a doll. I have a doll that somebody loaned me to take to my meetings. It says, I'm going to a meeting to discuss what we discussed at the last meeting. And it's very appropriate.
Yes.
Meeting item regurgitation.
Well, I want to fulfill my duty to our county council representing us, that they'll continue to represent us as long as we're making progress. So we'll make progress. I'm not sure what it is, but we'll get there. That's mine. All yours, Maria. Anything on what we're doing, in case anybody wants to know, is members forum information and future agenda item requests.
No. Nothing for me.
Ed, you're okay?
Just fine. Nothing.
Nothing.
You guys are getting easy. Ron?
Nothing.
Jim?
Nothing, Mr. Chairman.
Nothing, Mr. Chairman.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Thanks to Mr. Burroughs being here today.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. The millionaire.
We'll never know.
Yeah, I know.
For the record,
as long as we win.
Not Mr. Rev.
Have to check, see what he's driving when you leave. I saw that Bentley downstairs there. I wasn't too sure who was driving.
That would be check my keys.
Okay, staff.
Those are pretty good.
Just a reminder, Mike Lynch, Ron Martin, Darren Garrett will be meeting immediately after this meeting in the conference room for the ad hoc committee on excess earnings and funding policy.
Yay.
Are we going to have refreshments?
Can we have refreshments?
Can we have M&M's and water?
Can we have a time clock or one of those things?
Meeting adjourned. Speeches.